Iowa's farmers feed the world, but 85% of the food that we eat comes from outside of the state. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning, I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today, and as more and more people are trying to eat local foods, the demand for locally grown fruits and vegetables, horticultural crops, is growing. Linda Nave and Richard Gerond from Iowa State University Extension are here today, and we'll talk about the market for local foods and the opportunities that is creating from the perspectives of growers and from eaters. We'll also take your questions about what's going on in your yard or your garden. The number to call is 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk, or you can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Join the conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe, and it is Horticulture Day today on Talk of Iowa. And right now we're going to focus on local foods. There has been a lot more demand lately for locally grown fruits and vegetables in the state of Iowa. Those are referred to as horticultural crops. And of course, that means that our guests, Richard Gerond and Linda Nave, have a lot to do with local foods and at least giving advice to those who are hoping to grow them. Linda and Richard, thank you for being here today.
Yeah, it's good to be here. It's a beautiful morning.
It is a beautiful morning. We've had quite a stretch here, haven't we?
We have.
Well, Linda, let's start by talking about local foods. You know, we see people talk about it. We hear people talk about it. We see a lot of articles about it. But how do you define what local foods are?
Well, you know, Charity, today it's amazing. You open any paper any day and there's a small article or a large article or a featured article on the local food movement. So it's getting a lot of attention. But everybody talks local foods, but nobody really has a definition for what that local is. For some, it could be within 25 miles of home. For others, it could be 250 miles from home. And some refer to as state local. For example, Iowa Department of Agriculture has their Choose Iowa program, which focuses on locally grown, meaning what is manufactured, grown, or produced here in Iowa. It could be raw products. It could be processed or manufactured in Iowa. So that Choose Iowa is a trademark state identity promotional program that looks at local foods from a state perspective. But local is not clearly defined. In the Chicago market, for example, local could be anything from Indiana, Illinois, or even Iowa, Wisconsin, or Michigan. That's what they define as local. But here most of us think of local as what our neighboring counties have produced in the way of fruits and vegetables. But not, I focus on that because that's my area. But local foods also refers to meats and other products that can be grown, eggs, dairy, meat products. These all fit into that local foods mindset.
Well, it seems like the push for local is coming from a couple of different directions. I mean, I remember even 12, 13 years ago, the state was beginning to push, you know, buy Iowa-made products.
Mm-hmm.
But this conversation that we're having today about local food seems to be coming from a different place altogether.
It's coming from our national initiatives. For example, it was late last year that Secretary of Agriculture Vilsack announced the Know Your Farmer, Know Your Food initiative, in which a lot of national programs and initiatives and grant opportunities became available for local produce and local food production. We call them specialty crop grants, whether it be fruit and vegetable, it could be Christmas trees and things like that. That will Know Your Farmer, Know Your Food will help the local economy, and it will help build greater awareness, and it's environmentally more sound.
And I think those national initiatives are coming from a grassroots movement.
Very grassroots, Charity. There are a number of local initiatives here in Iowa. Northeast Iowa Food and Fitness, Pathways, RC&D down in Southwest Iowa. A number of initiatives going on with the local foods movements. And it's great because this is where it's going to start, building awareness at the local level. We can have things come from above and from nationally, but unless the local people get on board, it isn't going to happen. The Leopold Center has done a number of studies.
And that's at Iowa State University.
Yeah, at Iowa State University. And when we look at the economy and we look at our local food miles, a food mile is the distance the food travels from where it's produced to where it's ultimately purchased by the consumer or end user. And it's kind of easy to calculate for, like, say, a tomato. single item, non-processed, from the time it leaves the farm until it's purchased. If we look at the Leopold Center did a study and they looked at estimating lettuce grown in California's San Joaquin Valley, which is where most of our lettuce, let's say romaine lettuce right now comes from, right now being October. It's transported to supermarkets in Des Moines. It'll travel approximately 1,400 miles. If we purchase Chilean grapes in the wintertime, they go through California, then our truck to Des Moines, 7,200 miles. That's a lot of carbon footprint going on there. So by growing locally, it gives our local economy a boost, and it also gives our carbon footprint a reduction as far as the carbon dioxide that's emitted and the amount of travel. A study also done by the Leopold Center, in which they looked at a six-state area, Iowa, Illinois, Indiana, Michigan, Minnesota, and Wisconsin. And by converting a relatively few amount of acres to grow fruits and vegetables, significant job gains can be made by producing more local grown foods, not only by the grower, but also the food chain down the way. They found that in one scenario, by increasing local production of 26 different fruits and vegetable crops in those six states, they estimate it could generate about $882 million in sales at the farm level, creating more than 9,300 jobs and about $395 million in labor income that stays right here in Iowa in our local states.
Now that there has been an increasing demand for local foods, of course, people who sell foods are responding because it's what their customers want. But where are the places where it's easiest to get locally grown food?
Well, one of the first things that comes to mind for most people is their local farmers markets. And there are an increasing number of farmers markets around Iowa and around the country. And if you say, well, I don't have a local farmers market in my community, you can go to the Iowa Department of Agriculture's farmers market directory and find a farmers market nearby that you can go to. And you'll find many communities have not only one, but two or three on several different days. So that's one way in which we can actually meet the farmer who grew our food, or raised our food, or produced our food. On-farm sales are another one. Right now, we see a lot of orchards that are having a lot of on-farm sales in which they're direct marketing to the consumer right at their orchard stand, or on-farm with pumpkin farms. CSAs are becoming more and more popular in communities. A CSA, we refer to it as CSA, but that stands for Community Supported Agriculture. And in this case, again, it's the consumer knows who grew their food. As a matter of fact, may have even participated in the production of that food. Community Supported Agriculture is in which you, the consumer, would buy a share of that farm and that farm's produce. You commit to it early in the season. You help the farmer with his expenses for seed and fertilizer and pest management and labor. And in return, you get a weekly supply of fruits and or vegetables. That's either you pick up at a certain point or it's delivered at your home. So there are a number of these going on, and they've been going on for 20, 25 years. But they've just really taken hold and become popular throughout the state. Make it very convenient. You know where your food comes from. You get to visit with the farmer on the way it's produced. But at the same time, the consumer shares the risk of the production season with the farmer. If the farmer has a tomato failure, you absorb that cost, and you may not get as much produce that year if it's a bad year. But on a good year, at the same time, you may get more. So it's investing in the farms. Restaurants and grocery stores are also really keying in on local foods. Many of them advertise restaurants that they are purchasing locally will tell you who the farmer is that actually grew that lettuce or grew that squash or potatoes. There are grocery stores, co-ops throughout Iowa, such as New Pioneer. They're in Iowa City, Wheatsfield in Ames. The Gateway Market in Des Moines purchases and features a lot of local foods, Whole Foods, and there are others. So if you're looking for local foods, where can you find them? There are a number of online sources of information. Iowa Market Maker, just Google or do an online search for Iowa Market Maker, will put growers in contact with buyers and buyers in contact with growers or producers of any food crop, whether it could be jams, jellies, berries, meat. It could be niche meat. It could be, if you're looking for organic or specialty crops, you can find it on Iowa Market Maker.
I saw an article yesterday in the New York Times that said that Walmart is actually going to start buying local food. So even the large chains seem to be keying into this desire.
That's right. Walmart is one of them that are really keying in, and some of our local grocery store chains are also doing that by trying to aggregate more growers to provide the quantity that's needed. And that's the biggest issue right now is we can't just bring in 30 bushels of apples because the grocery stores will go through 3-4 times that much. And if we want to do it at a wholesale level, there's another localharvest.org on the line that you can find locally grown produce as well. So there are some directories and resources out there if you're really interested. Now, the Iowa Department of Agriculture has a farmers market directory, a Christmas tree growers directory, which we can find locally grown Christmas trees. Iowa Fruit and Vegetable Growers Directory is another source for those who have registered with the Iowa Department of Agriculture.
With this growing demand, have you seen, and the people that you work with at the Leopold Center, et cetera, have you seen a lot more people wanting to get into this kind of farming?
Yeah, that's a really good question. Yes, there is some interest. We need to encourage more production. If we are going to have a high demand for local produce, somebody's got to grow it or produce it. And so that's become a real concern. We are doing a number of workshops, a number of activities to help encourage growers. There are some initiatives that are coming down from the legislature that will give a boost and assistance to those who are just getting started in fruit and vegetable production. So there is assistance out there for knowledge base as well as for financing. So a farmer needs to look into that. And we at Iowa State University Extension are really committed to that with our Beginning Farmer Center, Leopold Center for Sustainable Agriculture, and us in Value Added Ag. We're committed to helping growers become more educated and understand markets and production.
When we think about the more traditional kind of farm in Iowa, the corn and soybean farm, to make a real go of it, you need to have a lot of acreage. But it seems like with these horticultural crops, people can grow a lot of food and on a much smaller amount of land. Do you find that that's true?
Oh, that's very true. You could make a good living off of 10 acres of vegetable production if you have good markets and if you have continuous production. Continuous production doesn't necessarily mean 10 acres in tomatoes. It could be a diversified farm of various vegetables and a diversified market for those crops. Direct farm sales, retail, and or wholesale. And now growers are finding, you know, our growing season's limited here in Iowa. You know, you think we can have April through maybe September, but growers are now extending the season several weeks before the typical season and several weeks after by using high tunnels.
Well, and we'll talk more about that in just a moment. It is Horticulture Day on Talk of Iowa. My guest right now is Linda Nave from Iowa State University Extension. Richard Giron is here as well, and we will continue to talk about extending the growing season and locally grown food. We'll also be taking your calls at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe, and it is Horticulture Day today on Talk of Iowa. We've been talking about locally grown foods and how the local foods movement has created opportunities for growers and, of course, for those of us who like to eat local foods as well. And my guest is Linda Nave of Iowa State University Extension. Richard Giron of Iowa State University Extension is also here today, and we will be taking your calls as well. If you have questions about what's going on in your yard or your garden, the number is 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk, or you can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And Linda, just before the break, we started to talk about how growers can extend their season because, of course, the growing season in Iowa, it's a good one, but it is a short one. And you mentioned high tunnels, which I think a lot of people have heard referred to as hoop houses
That's right. Hoop houses and high tunnels are used synonymously. They're covering very similar to greenhouse structure, except they're much simpler. They have the steel structure, and then they're covered with heavy-duty, specially produced polyethylene plastic that's about 6 mil, and the sides roll up. And the crops are grown directly in the soil. not like on a greenhouse bench or something like that. They're very simply operated. They're manually operated the sides, so you get manual ventilation, just natural ventilation through them without no additional heat unless it's supplemented due to a late spring freeze to save the crop. But typically they're not heated, so they're not greenhouse structures. They're affordable for growers, and they can a tomato grower, for example, in central Iowa can plant a tomato crop in his high tunnel April 15th, and temperatures will get cool, but they'll come back, warm up, and we can be harvesting tomatoes in June rather than the end of July.
You said they're affordable for startup. How much would one cost?
It depends on the size. Now, we can get high tunnels that are very small, but the larger a grower goes with a high tunnel structure, the more economical it becomes for labor and the initial cost. Many growers now are going with somewhere around a 30-foot wide by 96-foot long high tunnel structure, and that could cost anywhere from $6,000 to $8,000, depending on the whistles and bells that you put on that with automated sides and additional ventilation and the kind of doors you put on them. So, but when people say, well, that sounds like an awful lot, well, in a good year, which you can get easily in a high tunnel, you can make your money back within a year. You're going to recover that initial $8,000 cost in 1 year.
How long can you extend the growing season? You mentioned planting tomatoes on April 15th. How long can you go into the winter months?
Into the winter months, let's say we want to plant a cool season crop in our high tunnel earlier than that. We can go in as early as February or March. We can actually plant in the winter for a spring crop and wait until that spinach comes up. It'll sit there through the winter months, maybe put another little row cover over it inside. It won't grow much, it won't die, but the minute the temperatures start becoming conducive for good plant growth, those little spinach plants or lettuce are going to take off, and you may have something available for market, depending on the year, in March. And then once that's done, you can go in at the tomato crop. So there you've added at least 3 months to your production season in that end. And then on the other side, you can go in the fall and plant another fall crop of lettuce, greens, a longer season for carrots or whatever, and take that clear up maybe until Christmas time. The problem we run into here in Iowa, though, people say, well, I will grow them year-round. Well, our day length is shorter, and our light levels are significantly less in the winter months. So some of our crops would really struggle. But if we can take that from a 4 to 5 month production season and boost it up to a 7, 8 month, 9 month production season, that's adding a significant amount of produce to our local markets.
Linda, I think a lot of people who grow these crops start out as part-time farmers or hobby farmers, and it sounds like a really labor-intensive practice. Do you find people who can make a go of it as a hobby farmer and selling at the farmers markets?
Oh, yes. Some families are doing it very effectively as a family venture, but it is extremely labor-intensive, and when you start out small, you are more manual. As the production system increases, you become more mechanized, and then, of course, the machinery costs more money, so it's kind of a trade-off. How large do you want to get and mechanize rather than be manual and more labor? Labor is probably labor and weeds are probably the number one, number two problem that growers are facing at coming up with labor. And our food supply is extremely cheap when we think about it being produced in California. But with locally produced foods, if you think just because it's not traveling as far as going to be cheaper, that is not the case because we have more labor involved in the process.
Well, if you have any questions for Linda about high tunnels, about local foods, about anything, and Richard, you're here as well. Hi, Richard.
Hi.
Very quiet. But if you have any questions about your yard or garden, do give us a call at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk, or you can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And Marcy is on the line from Mechanicsville. Hello, Marcy.
Hi.
Hi.
Actually, I find this fascinating. My husband and I would like to start, you know, our own garden here to try and grow more things and then preserve more things. So this isn't my question, but is there a book that you would recommend on doing this kind of thing?
There are a number of books out there. There is an extension publication that you can get at the Iowa State Extension website, and it's called Small Farm Vegetables, an Opportunity, something like that. And it's available on the website. Go to Extension, go to their publications list, and click on Vegetables, and you'll find this publication. It's downloadable, and it gives you some really good information and some real think topics before you get started in this. I think it's an excellent introduction, and it's free, and it's just an overview. Now, if you want to get into more detail on vegetable production and season extension, Elliot Coleman is kind of the guru in that, and he grows crops out in Maine. And he's got some books like Four Seasons Harvest. That's excellent if you're going to get started in this. It's a good guide. But remember, okay, he's in Maine and not Iowa. So a little bit different, right, growing conditions there. But overall, it's a good starting point for that. But I would start with our own Iowa State resources.
Perfect. Okay, well, my question actually is, I have a redbud tree that's about, I'm going to guess it's about 6 years old. And just recently, in the last probably 2 to 3 years, it hasn't bloomed. The only thing that I can think of that we've changed around it is we built a house, and we had a house there previously, so we had to move a bunch of plants. So we moved a lot of, like, hosta and, some kind of shady plants over around it. Is there anything I can do? I mean, it still grows just fine. I mean, it leaps out and, it doesn't have any dead spots in it or anything, but it just doesn't bloom.
Okay. Well, possibly the last couple of years we've had some very cold, wet winters. And it may be that the flower buds are not surviving the winter. They are formed basically in summer of the previous year. And so they do have to survive the winter. And we've had two very cold winters the past 2 years. So that could be an explanation where maybe the flower buds are not surviving the winter. The leaf buds are separate. They're typically more cold hardy than the flower buds. And so that might be a possibility where maybe the flower buds are being destroyed by the cold temperatures. And you can't do anything about that. So hopefully, if we have a mild winter, then it may bloom again. But there's typically no need to fertilize it. If it's growing well, that's a good sign. So it may be maybe a cold hardiness issue.
All right, Marcy, I hope that helps. We have an email from Allie. It says, I have a large fern that has been outside all summer and needs to come inside. How do I get rid of the resident insects before bringing it inside? I've heard that you spray it with soapy water. If that is the best method, how do I do that? What kind of soap? How strong a solution? How do I treat the soil, etc.? Thank you.
Well, I wouldn't treat the soil, but you can buy insecticidal soap at most garden centers and other retailers that have garden supplies. And just go ahead and apply that according to label directions. Do that outside. Make sure that you get the material on the underside of the foliage also, not just on the top. So give it a really thorough bath, and then bring it inside, and hopefully everything is okay.
All right. Well, I hope that helps out with that question. Also, we have an email from Janine who says, should I be watering trees and perennials since it's been so dry lately?
If they're established, they should be okay. But if they've been planted, let's say, this year or last year, you may want to go out there and check the soil. And if the soil is extremely dry, go ahead and water them thoroughly. And then come back maybe in a week or two and see if they're getting dry again. And if they are, water again. Basically, water newly planted things until the ground actually freezes in winter.
Okay. Tony's on the line in Cedar Rapids. Hello, Tony.
Hi. Yes, I've got two carpet rose bushes and two peony bushes that I want to actually trade places with. And I was wanting to know if this is a good time of year to be able to pick them up and transplant them.
Well, you have roses and peonies.
Yeah.
Okay. That makes it difficult.
It
because the best time to move a rose would be early spring before bud break, so in early April. The best time to move a peony actually is in the fall, like in September. So okay. It's kind of hard to do. I guess what you could possibly do is go ahead and dig up the peonies and maybe put those in large pots. And then water them in nicely, and then put the pots back in the ground to overwinter them. And then next spring, you can dig up the pots without disturbing the plants too much, the peonies. Also, dig up the roses before they leaf out and trade places.
Okay.
So that's a possibility. The peonies are pretty tough, so I think if you dig them up, put them in pots, water them in nicely, and then sink the pots back in the ground, they should overwinter just fine, and then dig up the roses next spring and transplant.
Okay, can I, I've got a zebra grass plant that I want to transplant too. Can I do that right now, or do I have to wait until next spring to do that?
Spring would be the best time on ornamental grasses. We cut them back typically sometime in April, and as they're just starting to show signs of life, that's when we dig them up and move them. So spring would be a good time there.
Okay. Right. Thank you very much.
Thanks a lot for your call, Tony. And Julie is on the line from Ames at 866-780-9100. Hello, Julie.
Hi.
What's your question?
I have a question about creeping Charlie in the grass. Is there something that I could apply that won't kill the grass but is not toxic?
Well, I think the best way of doing that is to use a herbicide, specifically something that contains either 2,4-D or triclopyr. Fall is by far the best time to do that. It typically takes two applications to do it. One application typically is not sufficient. So ideally, we would do this, maybe around late September, and do it a second time in late October, and that should take care of it. It's getting kind of late right now. I guess if you did it maybe this weekend, and maybe came back and did it the first weekend in November, if the weather is still good, that may be okay. Usually one application is not sufficient. And with ground ivy or creeping Charlie, you really don't have many options because you really can't dig it up in reality. It's really hard to do. So usually you have to use a herbicide.
Okay, so there's nothing natural. I've found different recipes online. People mm-hmm. are talking about mixed tobacco with vinegar and different stuff like that. But I just, I was trying to avoid chemicals if possible. But
yeah,
herbicide is the only way unless you dig it out. Not even digging it out will work.
It's hard. You'd almost have to destroy the entire area and start over. And you could. I mean, you could go out and simply dig up the entire area and destroy the grass and everything else and the mm-hmm. ground ivy and then reestablish the grass. You can go that route.
Right.
As far as the vinegar, I wouldn't use that.
Well, that would kill the grass, I would imagine, wouldn't it?
Yeah, I think it would too. And so vinegar tends to actually kind of burn down the foliage. It may not destroy the root system. It would tend to burn down the foliage. And it would not be selective, so it would basically burn down everything. So vinegar I don't see as a viable option.
Okay. All right, thank you.
All right, thanks a lot for your call, Julie. Probably some free-range chickens would help out there, but I don't know if the city of Ames approves of that. Of course, free-range chickens can take care of a lot of plants, not just creeping Charlie. If you have a question, you can call us at 866-780-9100 or tweet us at IPR Talk. We have Randy on the line from Iowa County. Hi, Randy.
Hi there. See, I've noticed at farmers markets that the foot traffic through is really dropped dramatically, and right now I'm picking Toyo turnips, and we'll have green beans, and there's carrots at market and all kinds of leaf crops down in Iowa City Saturday and other markets, so don't forget we're still out here bringing stuff to market, folks.
All right, well, and that's a good point, Randy. Linda, do you find that the market or the season for farmers markets is also being extended because a lot of farmers markets used to close mid-October?
Yes, they are. And I think it's a great thing that they're ongoing. And a lot of times it was, okay, it's the first freeze. Nothing will be available. There are a lot of things that can be stored on farm, can continue to be brought to the farmers market. And we really haven't had that killer freeze that's going to wipe out a lot of things this year. Now, our tomatoes are well past and green beans are probably done. But as he mentioned, there are a lot of things that are coming into the farmers market for a good fall meal. Don't forget about them because they're still there. Again, you can check the local farmers market directory on the Iowa Department of Ag website. You can see the months, the weeks that they're available, and their hours. Don't forget the farmers markets. They're still there. And we have a lot of farmers markets that have other products available besides just fruits and vegetables, honey, baked goods, things like that.
All right. And Dan from Sioux City sent us an email. He says, I have access to acorns and would like to start a couple of oak trees in my yard. How should I go about starting them from acorns?
Well, as soon as they fall to the ground, collect those, examine those. Any that have holes in them probably are not going to germinate. And then plant those immediately. There are two different types of oaks, and some of the acorns germinate immediately, so they need to be in the ground as soon as you collect those. Plant them about half inch deep or so, maybe an inch, and hopefully next spring they'll germinate and grow.
All right. Should you mark where you plant them so you don't mow them in the spring?
I definitely would. In fact, you might want to put maybe a little flag there so you know where they are, or maybe a little ring of chicken wire fencing or something like that.
All right. You're listening to Horticulture Day on Talk of Iowa. I'm here with Richard Giron and Linda Nave of Iowa State University Extension. You can join the conversation with your questions at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPRTalk, and you can send us email at talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio, and it is Horticulture Day today. With me are Iowa State University Extension horticulturists Richard Giron and Linda Nave, and you can join with your questions at 866-780-9100. You can also tweet us at IPR Talk or send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And Susan is on the line in Des Moines. Hello, Susan.
Yes, I have what looks like a concolor fir or a Norway spruce. It's about 10 years old. It's beautiful, very tall. But just this year, I noticed on the bottom right side, up about a fourth, there's a lot of brown, I don't know what you call them, like leaves or brown, whatever, browning. And I wonder what I could do.
Do you have branches that are totally brown?
Yes.
Then I would prune those out because they're dead. So if you have some branches that are totally brown, there's not a single green needle on them.
That's what I was looking for, the word needle.
Yeah.
Okay.
Then I would prune those off because they're dead. I'm not sure exactly why they died, but if they're totally brown, if they're dead, I would just prune those off.
Does it hurt to prune them?
No, not if they're dead, because they're not.
And the other, is it okay to prune evergreens now?
Well, if they're dead, yes, we can prune them.
Healthy ones.
Well, you can always, when you have a dead branch in a tree, whether it's an evergreen or a maple tree or whatever, when you have a dead branch in that tree, you can prune it any time during the year. It doesn't matter, because that dead branch is not doing anything useful as far as the tree is concerned. So if you have a dead branch, you can prune a dead branch any time during the year. Now, when you prune live branches, you typically prune those at specific times during the year. But a dead branch, you can do that any time. And if the entire branch is dead, then I would simply cut it back to the trunk of the tree.
But when is it a good time to prune healthy evergreens?
Well, we normally don't really have to prune them a great deal. In the case of a concolor fir, we don't really prune them a great deal.
I mean, I have some, upright yews and that in the front, and they've really grown so big.
Okay.
Now I wonder, can I cut back on some of those and trim them?
Well, in the case of things like yews, that's the shrub, and you can prune them. Probably the best time to prune them would be like in early April, right before they start to grow. That would be a good time to prune them. You can also prune them in mid-summer, like in July. That's a pretty good time. We normally don't do it a great deal in the fall of the year. We kind of leave them alone. Sometimes they do suffer some winter injury, and any winter injury can be pruned out in early spring.
All right, Susan, thank you so much for your phone call. We have a tweet from Billy who wants to know what product can be added to peonies and roses to get larger blooms.
Well, I'm not sure there's a product that you have to use. The first thing is they need a suitable site where they get at least 6 hours of direct sun. It should be a well-drained, fertile soil, so they need good growing conditions at the site. If they have that, they should bloom nicely. They can fertilize. Definitely they can do that. They can fertilize in the spring, and I would just use an all-purpose garden fertilizer. In the case of roses, you can fertilize them maybe two or three times during the summer. Peonies once, but make sure they have plenty of sun. That's the main thing, and a good soil.
And with roses, they'll bloom, and they do need to be, that old bloom needs to be removed in order to get a good flush of new blooms coming up. So the rule of thumb is to go back to a five leaflet and just prune right above that little five leaflet leaf. So that's kind of a good rule of thumb to go by. People say, well, how far back? That's how far back you go.
All right. And we have, on the subject of roses, Donna sent us an email, and she says, how do you winterize a Seven Sisters rose bush with 15-inch canes? She must mean foot.
Mm-hmm.
It's on a 7-foot trellis on the west side of a building.
You probably can't a great deal. If we have a very cold winter, there may be some dieback on that. I suppose you could, it would be very difficult to do, but I suppose you could try to maybe wrap some things around it. If the canes are that tall, that would be very difficult to do, but I suppose you could try where you might take some straw or some other material and first kind of maybe tie the canes together with some twine, and then place some straw around that, and then maybe burlap around that. But that is so hard to do.
Dangerous. They bite.
You'd want to make sure you have gloves on and things like that. But I think I would be inclined just to let it go and hope for the best.
Okay. And Crystal in Coralville has some ambitious plans. She says, I have a great grow light set up inside to start my tomatoes and peppers in the spring. Is this light going to be sufficient enough to try and grow things like lettuce during the winter months? If I can do this, is there anything special I would need for the plants? Would there be anything else I could grow indoors?
You could grow your lettuce indoors. The key is to have lights that are good quality, grow lights that are full spectrum lamps rather than your typical ones that you would put in your fluorescent light in your kitchen or whatever. So go and get a specialty grow light that fits that equipment. And then the next thing is you've got to have that grow light within 6 inches of the leaf surface, the top of the plant. The reason for this is as you go beyond that, you're really reducing your light intensities. What our plants need is a combination of duration and intensity. If we can give them the intensity and a little longer duration, we'll get a pretty good little crop out of that. Lettuce can be grown pretty easily under a grow light. You're not going to get a whole lot because the grow light's not going to accommodate that much, but it's fun to do, keeps you going through the winter months. Your tomato seedlings, the same thing. If you have a grow light and you have it going year-round, but you don't need to leave it on 24 hours, you need to replace that every year. Now, if you're just using it for 6 to 8 weeks in the winter months to start your tomato transplants, that'll last, you know, 2 or 3 years. But keep that in mind, too. It may not look like it's reduced in light intensity. It's still emitting a lot of light, but the plants can tell.
All right. Well, good luck with that, Crystal. And if you'd like to join our conversation, we do have time for some more calls. 866-780-9100 is the number. You can also tweet us at IPR Talk or send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. 866-780-9100. And Chad is on the line. Hello, Chad.
Hello.
What's your question?
Oh, my question is, how do you tell the difference between walnut trees? I'm looking at cutting down an old tree that's a walnut, but I'm not quite sure because it's the bark and that off of it for lumber sale, and I was just curious to see in that how to tell the difference between the walnuts.
Okay, it's in regards to what as far?
like a black walnut or, you know, there's different types of walnut.
Okay. You would base it on the foliage and the fruit. They're slightly different. They are similar in many respects, but they are slightly different in the leaf structure and also in the fruit. So you need both of those to kind of identify the tree.
Okay.
And is there any way that Chad could get help with that if he doesn't have the knowledge to, I mean, you can taste a black walnut and you know it's a black walnut if you know what that
right.
tastes like, but.
I guess I would look at reference books. I would probably go online if I have a computer and do some Google image searches and look for foliage and fruit and then compare the two, because they are obviously very closely related, but there are some slight differences there.
Okay.
All right. Well, good luck with that, Chad.
Well, and, thank you very much.
You know, I know it was a bad year for a lot of trees, but boy, have we had an amazing walnut crop in our yard. Have you seen a lot of walnut trees really giving it their all this year?
Well, I think that kind of varies. Walnuts tend to bear heavily in alternate years. And so if you didn't have any much last year, then likely this year you're going to have a big, huge crop. So that tends to be the key. So what happened last year does affect what happens this year.
All right. Well, we could sure use some more squirrels in our yard to help us clean up. So if you see any homeless squirrels, send them our direction.
But
okay.
Then you'll have walnut trees coming up everywhere
right.
probably
we,
next
we
spring.
Already do. We already do. All right. Walt is on the line in Waterloo. Hello, Walt.
Hello.
What's your question?
I got some hedge roses. They look like little wild roses. And they really, really are spreading out. And I was just wondering, what's a good time to, like, cut them down? And how far down can I cut them to the ground to where they'll be coming up again next year with no problem? I mean, they're about 7 foot tall right now.
Okay. If they're some type of shrub rose, which apparently they are, I would go out early next spring before they leaf out, probably sometime in late March, early April. And I would try to remove maybe a third of the plant. And when I say that, I would select some of the larger canes and cut those off near the ground or as close to the ground as I can and leave some of the smaller ones, but remove about a third of the plant. And then the next year I might remove some more, again removing some of the old growth and basically kind of rejuvenating the plant over 2 or 3 years, getting rid of the old growth and encouraging new growth. I wouldn't go out there and just cut it off, let's say, 3 feet above the ground. I would rather remove specific branches or stems near the ground and do it that way.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thanks a lot for your call, Walt. And if you have a question, you can call us at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk or send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And Judy in Cedar Rapids has a question. Hi, Judy.
Hi. You said you could prune dead branches from any kind of tree anytime, and I want to know if that applies to oak trees, too, because I know you have to be careful about oak wilt.
Yeah, that would be probably the only exception. there's always one exception for everything, but right, we're concerned about oak wilt in regards to pruning oak trees.
Right.
And we would prefer to prune those basically in December, January, and February.
Okay.
That's the best time.
That was what I thought. But
yeah, if the branch is totally dead, you could probably do it earlier on, but I would prefer to do that in December, January, and February, where there's really no risk at all of oak wilt infections.
Oh, okay. Thank you.
All right. Thanks, Judy. That's a colder job than I think she was hoping for, probably.
That's for sure.
Michelle is on the line in Des Moines. Hello, Michelle.
Hi there. I had a question. I put a vegetable garden in for the first time this year, and now that everything's pretty much finished, what do I do with the garden so I have it in the best condition for the spring to plant again?
Well, it's my guess is it's probably a very pretty small patch you have in your backyard, I would remove all of the dead plant debris off of that. Get rid of the, store the cages, the stakes. Don't leave it as it is and have to deal with it next spring. Because if you grew tomatoes, that dead tomato debris and foliage and plants will harbor some of the diseases that you may have seen evident this summer. So, and make it worse. So I would go out and I would take everything off the garden that you can, so you avoid these problems. You can till it this fall or till some of that material in too, depending on the slope that you have, so you don't have a lot of erosion problems. But if it's a nice level surface, there's no reason why you can't go in and rototill or some of that under.
And how about planting a ground cover? Would that still be an option for you?
No, I wouldn't bother with that.
Okay. Thanks a lot for your call, Michelle.
Thank you.
Good luck. And Jim is on the line. Hello, Jim.
Yes. Thanks for taking my call. I have a pear tree that's about 50 feet tall, and it's a lot of the pears are way out of my reach, and I was wondering when the best time to trim that and how far back can I trim it?
Well, the best time to prune it would be basically March, early April, before it leaves out. You can prune it. I would not top it. Topping is just going out there and cutting out the top of the tree, and that's not really a good practice. But you can definitely prune it and maybe reduce the size somewhat. But March, early April would be the best time.
All right. And how far can he prune that back? Can he really whack it so that it's short enough for him to pick the pears from?
Well, they can reduce the overall size, let's say, by maybe a third or so would be okay. But they shouldn't just indiscriminately chop out the top. That's okay. Topping, and that's not going to produce a good tree.
All right. Good luck with that, Jim. And Scott is on the line in Waterloo. Hello, Scott.
Hello.
Hi, what's your question?
Okay, this summer I built a greenhouse, and we're not sure what type or what temperature range it should be in the wintertime. We've got some tropicals, annuals, veggies.
Well, you've got quite an assortment there that some can tolerate a little cooler and others better not get much below 50 to 60.
Okay, yeah, well, I'm tired of taking all the tropicals in the basement.
the tropicals time would be the key. I think they would prefer temperature probably around 70 to 75.
Mm-hmm. And not any lower than that if you're having a heating issue. So,
I think they would probably find temperatures around maybe 50, 55 to be a little bit on the cool side for them. So. They require warmer temperatures than some of the other things do. So if you have, let's say, a corner that might be a little bit warmer than the rest, you could put them there and maybe the other ones in a cooler part of the greenhouse and maybe do it that way.
Should I keep closest to the actual polycarbonate walls that's going to get the most sun from the south and the west?
Probably the tropicals. A lot of those like a lot of sun, so...
Mm-hmm. Okay, and how about as far as humidity? Should I put a humidifier in there?
Well, many of the tropicals would benefit from high humidity. In the wintertime, the air tends to be quite dry when you heat it up. So some way to increase the humidity would be, I think, beneficial for most plants.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much.
All right. Thanks so much for your call. And thank you very much, Richard and Linda.
You're welcome.
Yep. Richard Giron and Linda Nave of Iowa State University Extension, they join us, or someone from the Horticulture Department joins us each Friday to talk about the things that you grow in your yard or your garden. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. It's produced by Dennis Reese. Our executive producer is Jeff Schmidt. Production assistance today from Christina Sarnelli. We got technical support today from Russell Mansky in Ames. Podcasting and on-demand audio of Talk of Iowa are available at iowapublicradio.org, and you can send us email anytime. We'd love to get your feedback, or if you have an idea for something that you'd like to hear on the show, send us email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. I'm Charity Nebbe. Have a great weekend.